Cash number 7363.
Mr. Jameson, tape 13. Keeping on the subject of leave, did you find that you, when you went back to England, that people had any idea of the true nature of the situation at the front? Did they really understand what was going on there?
No, I don't think so. And I don't think, quite frankly, in all fairness to people who were in England and never actually experienced anything like it, I don't think it was possible for them either to appreciate what it was like or for any participant in it to convey what it was like. You could try and picture a sort of thing, and yet you felt that it just, you just couldn't portray to them the whole atmosphere, the nervous situation, the very often hopeless situation that might be prevalent at the time. No, I never. I think it was never possible to convey to anybody just exactly what the conditions were. You could tell us. You could sort of describe it. But I don't think anybody had the gift of description to the extent that it would go into somebody else just exactly what that place meant to that person at that time.
Did you find there was still enthusiasm for the war at home when you returned?
No, I didn't think there was. It wasn't enthusiasm. I wouldn't say it was enthusiasm. I would say that people were hopeful that it would end. They never felt, I must say this, that they never felt that we would lose the war, but they felt that it was a very long, drawn-out sort of thing, that it was something that we just had to hope would end somehow, somewhere, but at that time, not quite sure how and or what. As I say, the news that the Americans were coming in was a great boost to morale, I think. The very fact that we were getting all that manpower and all those resources to back us. Because, you see, it wasn't just America coming in. It was the war of attrition in the Atlantic, which was also going on. It was all the sinking by the submarines and so on. That was going on that concerned us.
You were saying about the boost to morale of the Americans coming in. Conversely, did you find it was rather depressing when the Russian Revolution occurred and the Russian front collapsed? Did that affect morale at all?
I think it was. I don't think it affected morale, but I think it was a. It was just another feeling of a kick in the teeth. It was going to be longer. You see, it was going to take longer to do because the very fact of that collapse meant that those Germans would be released. We would have all that lot back. And it was going to make the job worse. That was really the feeling of it. I don't think anybody can believe any of the tales about the Russians. I think anybody who thought about Russia much thought it was rather a very autocratic sort of country with terrific poverty and oppression, and something of the sort was bound to happen one of these days. It was unfortunate that the effect of it would release a whole lot of German troops that we want tied up. And it was going to take longer to win the war as a result of it, I think.
When you went home on leave, did people make a fuss of you because you came from the front?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Something from another planet. People would often. This uncle of mine, who was the engineer, wanted me to talk about things and that sort of thing. I said, well, you know, uncle, I don't know whether you can sort of just appreciate the situation, whether I can paint it to you in any sort of way that you could feel what it was like to be in that situation. He, of course, was more keen on discussing battles and tactics and things, and I said, well, I wasn't on that level to be able to know much about the tactics. To us, we were told to do this, it was a job, get on with it, and there it was. It was like anything else. We weren't high enough up to be in the brainy part of the business, or the lack of brains, whatever. No, don't think so.
But your leaves were important to you, were they, getting back?
They were marvellous breaks. They were brief, too brief, but most enjoyable.
What did you appreciate most about being home?
The cleanliness, the peace and comfort. I felt most incensed when I was in England training at Ripon, that a Zeppelin came over and started to bomb the district. I thought, good God, I've come away from the war, that's not fair. Good, go back to where the war is, don't come here. That was the feeling I had when that first happened. Leaves were wonderful things. They felt, no sooner did you get home than they were gone again. I can always remember my mother being very tearful about my going back. I can remember coming on one leave when it coincided with my brother coming home, having got himself into him, joined the RFC, as it was then, the Royal Flying Corps, and wearing what they used to familiarly call a maternity jacket, you know, the thing that used to button over here. And he came back, and in a very sort of shamefaced way was asking me a question about how he cleaned this and cleaned that. And of course I'd been a territorial, and from being scoffed at, you see, before the war, when I used to be playing soldiers, what's all that, you see, I was very superior. I could tell him where he got off in a very gentle, pleasant sort of way. We both enjoyed it. And strangely enough, when we were attacking the Mormo Forest towards the end, having got over the main canal that runs right across France, the front of it there, and we were in this Mormo Forest was full of machine gun nests. After we'd compared notes later on, he told me that their tanks were attacking the flank of it and wiping these things out. Never knew he was there.
How many leaves did you have up until 1917? Blighty leaves, that is.
Yes. Well, I had the first one at 15 months. And then, of course, I was home in England. And then the next one would be round about 12 months. That was about the period after that. When we were... Yes, England. I went home just before Loos. I came back to England. When I went back again, I went on leave one time from round about... When those fellows were all shot, one after the other, and I had leave then. Then I had another leave just before we went to Italy. I think it would be one every 12 months, around between 12 and 15 months between.
Was that fairly typical?
That was fairly typical.
For officers or men,
yes,
as well?
Around about 12 months.
For officers and men?
Yeah.
Were you at the Battle of Passchendaele, the battle they call Passchendaele?
Well, I don't know. I'd like to look at a map and see what they called Passchendaele, because so far as my recollection goes, I would envisage that Passchendaele would extend from somewhere south of the salient to about north of Loos, about that. All that area which I remember as Neuve Chapelle, Aubers Ridge, all the way down there, going south from Ypres salient, I think that was Armentières district, ahead of Armentières, was all, I think, that was the Passchendaele region, as far as my, I wouldn't like to be at all certain about it. I never really knew what Passchendaele was. Whether Passchendaele was part of the Wichita Ridge or whatever, I don't know. But that, in my impression, Passchendaele covered a very wide area and was a very general term for a small village. That's all.
Were you in action from July, though, 1917? Would you have been in that area from July to September 1917?
Well, we came up from... We came up from the Somme to Vimy. We went on from Vimy up to Wichit. We were in action all around there. We seemed to be moved in and out every now and then. If they were going to do a little bit of bother to somebody, we pushed in. Somewhere I must come back and talk about army brigades, because when the idea was first mooted, we thought, shall I talk about it? When the idea of army brigades was first mooted, we sort of chucked our hats in the air and said, good, we're going to get away from all the red tape from division. We're going to be free. We're going to be corps troops, and it'll be marvellous. We'll be freed from all the trammels of red tab people buzzing around us and telling us to do this and that and the other, and often things we don't want to do. Well, what of course happened was that they took, they reduced the number of batteries in different divisions, and extracted bits from them and made these, formed them into army brigades. As for instance, in our case, they took one battery from the 50th Division, and they took two batteries and a howitzer from the 15th Division. And those three field batteries and a howitzer were the 72nd Army Brigade. Now, they kept... How they managed to win them, I don't know. But the fact is that they, as a result of it, they produced army brigades. How many they produced, I don't know. I'd like to know, as a matter of fact. I don't even remember coming across other army brigades. We didn't seem to have time, because we were corps troops, and every time there was a show coming on and we were moved to the front where it was to take place, corps promptly put us under the command of the divisional CRA of that front. So that, after all, what was he concerned with? He was concerned with his own divisional artillery and their care and welfare, and seeing they got everything. These people are an army brigade come here to help us in this push. But I, apart from getting all the help out of them and using them as much as possible, I don't have to bother very much more with them, that sort of attitude. And we were sort of dog's bodies, pushed around from one place to the next, so that what we had hoped was freedom was in fact... Just being shunted around one place after another, used in any push after another, augmenting the firepower in any place after another, and not considered very much as far as rests were concerned, leaves were concerned, all the little things that a divisional artillery might get given to them to help them along. We weren't nurtured the way the divisional artillery were. After all, we could imagine it, to each his own sort of thing. They were very clannish in their network. And we felt we were just footballs to be kicked about a bit. And what was more, I thought, more important too was this. When the war was over, and Ritchie had gone back as a garrison colonel, he'd gone back to India, and Colonel Ballard took over the brigade. He had us all paraded and inspected. And then he called the officers to a meeting at brigade headquarters, and he said, I've read your brigade records, and he said you seem to have been very gainfully employed in quite a large number of areas during this last war. And he said, I am very surprised that in moving along and inspecting your people, the people in the brigade this morning, I'm very much surprised to find so few decorations. Now, he said, it's not in the bounds of possibility that you could have been employed so often and in so many places and not get a certain number of worthwhile rewards for it. We said, well, what's the reason, he said. We said, well, we think the reason is this, that we were attached, corps sent us to a certain area and we were put under the command of a division and we would have a show. And the divisional commander would be very jealously recommending his own people for recommendations of this, that and the other. But we were just make weights and... not often, well, our recommendations didn't often get the attention they deserved. We think that what happened very often was, oh, they've gone to some other area, send the recommendation on there. That would go to there. It's like passing the ball around. So, and as we said, I said another thing, Colonel, that I have noticed. We came across our opposite numbers in the 50th Division only a short while ago. The other batteries that had comprised our brigade before we became army troops, corps troops, they're all stiff with decorations. And our fellows have got bare chests. Why? It's not good enough. He said, no, it's not good enough. And he said, what I'm now going to do is I'm going to read through your records and search through all these things, and I'm going to see that some of these things are not put right. And as a result of that, we had a whole spate of medals given to the men, not so much the officers but to the men. And now I'm quite sure, and this was the one thing that disappointed me, and I always felt very sad about it. I thought I'd done a worthwhile job at Vimy. I thought I'd really earned my keep. I thought that I'd been of great service, and the brigadier wouldn't have made a special journey to me up to say thank you if he hadn't been very impressed. So I thought, well, without blowing my hooter at all, I should have had a proper citation for that medal, which other people get. Now, I read in Colonel Sterling looked after his people well enough. All those officers in the 15th Divisional Artillery who got gongs in there were cited. And in our brigade, in the other batteries, regular officers were cited. We had a regular colonel. We were a territorial battery. I feel that we didn't quite get the right crack of the whip. I was always very sad that, as I say, that I felt I had done a first-class job under very difficult conditions at Vimy, and I had done something which the battalion commander and the officers that I, on the ground that I met and talked to, as far as they were concerned, they felt I'd really been of very great help to them in a very dangerous situation which could quite easily have resulted in the Jerry's breaking through that front and coming back towards the bottom of the ridge at least or something. But we'd stopped it, and they thought I'd done a good job. And I thought, as a result of that, well, of course, brigade told me that I'd been put in for this gong. And I thought, jolly good. I felt very bucked about it. You know, you stick your chest out and feel ha-ha, and it feels you like doing something better. And when it didn't happen, and it didn't happen, and nothing happened, and I began to feel a little bit disappointed.
Didn't you get your medal then?
Oh, eventually, yes. But eventually what had happened was, you see, that apart from the fact that this I'd been recommended for this medal, the nature of the recommendation, apart from the fact that it had been recommended, must have got sidetracked somewhere, because my recommendation and a medal in the Gazette there are a number of about so long of people who got military crosses, and there were a bulk of people who had been awarded military crosses simply because of the fact they'd been recommended at some time. But for why, especially, there was no citation for any of those people. And I think that they'd been lost in the post, so to speak. The fact that they should have had a medal was there, but the reason for giving them the medal was lost, and I think a lot of them, it was just one of these things. I've met that in the army before. After all, I did put in years, this is quite another thing altogether, I put in at one time for the Territorial Efficiency Medal. You counted your years, your war service as double, and my time in the Territorial Army and that double would have entitled me to a TEM, you see. I wrote to Territorial Army Records. I sent them photographs of myself at the first territorial camp. I sent them photographs of myself at the second territorial camp. I gave the dates. I gave the officers, I gave the commanding officers names. I told them exactly where all these things were. I said, I don't know how I can give you the evidence that I am who I am, but there I am on that photograph, and there are the dates stamped on these things. They'd been posted, you see, so they were date stamped. Now, I said, there is a record of service, and I think that on that basis I'm qualified to get that medal.
What is a TEM?
Territorial Efficiency Medal. It's for a certain length of service. If I'd been commissioned all the time, it would have been a territorial decoration. Because I'd started off as a corporal, as a gunner and a signaller and a corporal and so on, I could only go for the length of service. They didn't even bother to return the photographs and the details and the dope I sent to them from the records office. They simply said that the territorial records relating to all that period had been destroyed by enemy bombing action, and they couldn't do anything about it. In spite of the fact that I showed them all this stuff, I proved to them that I had that service. Whatever records they had lost, I had produced records, but they wouldn't accept that. They wouldn't even accept that I'd been in that unit at that date, because their records had been bust. The fact that I could show them pictorial record with a post office date stamp on the back to prove I had been in it wasn't good enough. Now, that's stuffed shirt, in my opinion. And that was another example of officialdom, you see, going adrift. And I think that was where the army brigades suffered. They should really, I think, in the case of the army brigades, the idea was a good one. The fact that they could mobilize gunpowder, the fact that they could shift it quickly, they could throw it into any position without all the trammels of moving divisions, just move the guns to help the divisions and leave the divisions where they were, was a very good concept. But what they should have done was they should have put somebody no less than a general as the commanding administrative officer over the whole of the army brigades to see that they got their fair whack, to see that they got fair treatment administratively, not tactically at all, simply the admin side of it. Look after these boys, they're doing a good job, that sort of thing, you see, and they should have had a general to do it. An overriding general over the whole of the corps troops, not just tack them onto any corps that wanted a few army brigades. It wasn't really the staff officer's job to look after those people, really. They had enough on their plates. Once they developed that unit with the idea of making it a mobile lot that could be shunted about at will, and pushed in wherever it was wanted, easily maneuvered, easily shifted, and shifted from here and put in there, stop that gap or this one. The idea was very good, but I say they should have had a commanding general as the top admin man who could fight for their rights. Their trade union, in other words. I think that was where the concept of the army brigade was so lacking. where they did, by the very nature of their job, they did a thundering good job, and a very continuous job, really. They were constantly employed. Now, I think that where divisions were taken out and rested, army brigades were shunted into behind to back up some other division that was having a bit of bother. You see, so they were much more called upon and under stress than divisional troops were. And I think they should have had a top-ranking general to safeguard their interests, so that while they were doing that job, they were also being paid for it, so to speak. There was, I think, the weakness.